Well, hello and welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs In Conversation vidcast with me, Sai Kamal. Now, during In Conversation, members of the IA team are joined by academics, commentators and experts to discuss the pertinent issues of the week and some of the latest research. Cast your mind back to March when the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic was coming under fire. And around that time, the Behavioural's Insight team was thrust into the spotlight. And in deploying behavioural science, it was believed that desirable behaviours could be achieved without significantly impacting on day-to-day activities. Now, since then, when the British public were first encouraged to sing either one verse of the national anthem or Happy Birthday twice while washing their hands, 16,000 people have died from the coronavirus. In fact, our Prime Minister spent 3 days in intensive care, and the British people have spent 4 weeks in lockdown. And the Chancellor announced a £330 billion package to keep the UK economy afloat until the crisis has passed. On the continent, however, we're seeing several countries that are starting to relax restrictions, albeit with some trepidation. And they'll be doing so under intense scrutiny as other governments try to forge past out of the lockdown. The dilemma facing all political leaders is as complex as it is vexing. Information and data about COVID-19 are imperfect and incomplete, and estimates about infection, fatality rates, and the speed at which testing can be rolled out are informed guesses. Behaviour will play a key role in easing the current lockdown, and economics has a valuable contribution to make to this. Perhaps, therefore, economists need to speak up. Now, I'm delighted to be joined today by the economist, author, and entrepreneur, Paul Ormerod, whose paper on epidemiology and behaviour will soon be published by the IEA. But before we get started, you can find all our online content on our IEA YouTube channel. So don't forget to subscribe, but also check out our new IEA Daily Bulletin to make sure that you don't miss any of our fascinating and thought-provoking content. Paul, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
That's fine, thanks, yes.
So here we are, 4 weeks into lockdown. Have you been surprised at the willingness with which the British people have relinquished their civil liberties or, you know, gone along with the government advice? Were you expecting greater resistance?
Well, certainly, I think that was a fear in part of the government machine, that people were worried over a month ago there might be riots or civil disorder. But if we think about it, people were really reacting rationally to the information which was available at the time. A new pandemic, and that's a very scary word for many people, had arisen in China, and it was highly publicized that the death rates appeared to be 3 or even 5%, and that's truly terrifying. And they could see on their television screens how the health service in northern Italy had been completely overwhelmed, and their people were dying simply because there wasn't sort of basic oxygen available for them. So it was a very scary time. And so it's not really surprising that people did comply. And in fact, as we know, looking back the week of the 16th of March, when the Prime Minister announced restrictions which were voluntary, most people complied. Most people did start washing their hands. Most people did start being more careful and maintaining a certain amount of social distance. And I think it's interesting, there's some data from a group at Oxford University showing that respiratory diseases in general, not just a virus, but in general, started to fall in that week as people were taking, you know, basic health measures. So essentially, people were acting in a very rational way in terms of the information which was available from the time. A small minority didn't, and it's why the measures had to be made compulsory. But most people by the 23rd of March had actually altered their behaviour in response to the information and incentives presented.
And when the government starts to offer advice, do they always build in, presumably, a percentage of people that they expect not to follow the advice? And have you been surprised by the level of compliance, as it were?
Well, no, like I say, I mean, I've not been surprised by the level of compliance because people, you know, it was, you know, really quite the information appeared terrifying. It appeared that if you got it, you had a non-trivial chance of dying. Right. And if you got it, you might not get treated properly. So in those circumstances, it's not surprised that people said, "Oh my goodness, you know, I better change my behaviour. I better not go down to the pub," because I think that week of the 16th of March, you know, outside, you know, city centres where young people congregate, you know, most pubs were pretty empty. You know, already people had changed their behaviour really quite dramatically. And many businesses were already telling people work from home, you know, before the government made it compulsory.
If you look back to the daily government press conferences that they have, in terms, the question that always seems to come from journalists is, when are we going to get the lockdown? And now that seems to be getting through. You know, we're hitting the sort of fifth week of the lockdown, or we are in the fifth week now. And, you know, the government is starting to make noises about when they might get out the lockdown, another 3 weeks here, you know, then we'll review it, etc. Now, if the main focus of economics is individuals and the decisions they make and how these decisions can be influenced, do you think that economists should be playing more of a role in the form in forming an exit strategy?
No, absolutely. And I may say, if I may say so, the economics profession in the UK has been uncharacteristically hiding its light under a bushel. Because economists are normally at the forefront of policy making, and they seem to have rather shied away from this. Because a key thing about the epidemiological models that the government's relying on is that they don't try and explain behavioural change. If you say, we assume that behaviours change, so let's say social mixing has fallen by 80% or whatever, they can build it in, but they're epidemiologists. They're not trained in thinking about how to persuade people, how people might alter their behaviour. And so I think it's very important that economists should be involved. In fact, it's rather surprising that on the various, although I think their membership is technically a state secret, the various bodies that like nerve tag that advise the government on epidemics, I don't think there's a single economist on that. I think that's a serious it's a serious mistake by the government not to tap into this expertise.
And have you thought about why economists aren't coming forward? Is it because they're not being encouraged to come forward, or they're not pushing themselves forward, or they're not
being... Well, it's rather puzzling to me. I suppose, actually, very few economists know anything about epidemiological models. But I've always had a very broad interest in a whole range of things, some of which have been fruitful, some of which haven't been. But I did publish, in fact, with the IEA about 15 years ago, a paper on social networks and crime, in which I used an epidemiological framework to think about how somebody started off on a life of crime. So, you know, most crime is committed by poor young men. And so you think that's the susceptible population in epidemic terms. And then they gradually get drawn in. They start committing a few crimes, and then they become, if you like, infected and hardened criminals. And then they're removed by going to prison or whatever. So I've been interested in it for a long time. We can leave that bit out if you want, but you know.
No, it's very good.
I've been interested in this for a long time, but most economists know nothing about them. But in fact, although for the layperson, the mathematics is quite hair-raising, there's nothing in there to intimidate economists. And the epidemiological models at heart are essentially quite simple. And they should have taken the trouble to actually find out about them and to see what contribution they could make. So, for example, a key parameter in the epidemic models is what's the probability of being infected through contact with a single person who's infected. If you're infected and I meet you, what's my chances of getting the disease? So behavior can alter that. Social distancing alters that. And there's a parameter which isn't fixed, but it's open to modification, to behavioral modification. And again, they assume, I mean, some with varying degrees of sophistication, but the basic models, which are still widely used, assumed that the susceptibles and the infected mix at random. Now, to be fair, there are more sophisticated versions of that, but the degree of social mixing can be influenced, as we've seen, by behavior. Again, social distancing, being careful on public transport, etc. And economists have got a lot to say about these things, or ought to do. And these are assumptions in the models, the behavioral assumptions, and they're really quite critical in terms of the projections that you make. The even small variations in these assumptions can make dramatic differences to the predictions of how many people get the disease and so forth. And economists should have taken the trouble to learn about them and see how they could make a contribution. So I'd be critical of the profession for failing in this respect.
Well, let's see if we can address some of that failure, if you like. I mean, you know, when you think about the Behavioural Insights team and the government looking at this in terms of introducing and incentivizing behaviours to limit the spread of the disease, how do you think the government can achieve this? How can they incentivize these behaviours while allowing the public to resume normal day-to-day activities once we're ready to exit from the lockdown?
Well, I think although regulation can have a bad name, and a lot of it is tick boxing, and it has handicapped us in a number of ways. But there's a lot of evidence now that the virus is essentially spread by droplets in coughs and sneezes. And so simply making it compulsory, say, for using public transport or indeed in any public place, to have your face covered. You don't need a surgical mask because the point is, unless you're a health professional, the point is not to protect you from other people, it's to protect other people from you. And there's now strong evidence around the world that this makes a big difference. This simple measure makes a huge difference to how the virus might spread. Actually, my favourite example in terms of, that's regulation, in terms of incentives, Paul Romer, the 2018 Nobel laureate, has suggested, you know, one of the things that governments need to be able to do is to test for the virus. And he said he would offer, it should be offered a billion dollar prize for the first lab to be able to test 10 million samples a day. That's a big incentive. And yes, in terms of the overall scheme of things, why not offer it? Or yeah, even if it's just a million a day, you know, why not do that? So, you know, there's an example of regulation and an example of incentive, which are actually highly relevant to the current situation.
You know, you say that, the British public have been on the whole, have complied with the advice from the government. And in many ways, it seems that the government's campaign, some say call it propaganda campaign, but or information campaign, you know, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, has been effective. In fact, so effective that some people are concerned that when the restrictions are eased, people will, at the individual level, probably continue to self-isolate or socially distance. Do you foresee that? And what can the implications of this be?
Well, I think it is a problem because it's not just here. We can start to see in the European countries which are now gradually emerging from lockdown, say Austria, where the shops have been open for a few days, the problem seems to be that people aren't going into them. And it's always difficult to know what's going on in China. But even there, even in a police state, there does seem to have been difficulties initially in persuading people to go back to work, to persuade them that it was safe. So it was a very effective government slogan. It was very nicely crafted. It appealed to altruism, and it was a very clear message. And I think as well, by the media focusing on the number of deaths, this was driving home to people that this is a potentially fatal disease. Now, my feeling is in some ways this is partly overdone. I mean, not to diminish the impact of this disease, because early on it did seem very frightening. But now, a month, 6 weeks into it, it looks like the death rate for people who have no underlying condition is actually very low, comparable to a year of bad flu. And it's people with serious medical conditions already existing who are at risk. So the government could, in fact, have been too successful and by the media focusing on debt, it could be that people will be reluctant initially, even if they were to lift lockdown completely tomorrow, which of course, you know, wouldn't be a sensible thing to do. But that would be a problem. So I think, in fact, see, as you know, I've suggested with Gerard Lyons a sort of traffic light scheme, a phased scheme. And the idea of the traffic lights is to signal to people the level of danger. So red means we do some things, but we're still going to be very careful, and so amber until green. So it would be a phased transition and trying to give people a clear message as to how to continue to behave. So I think it is possible to come out of it. But the challenge that will then be to persuade people that it is getting safer.
There seems to be some debate between those who think that we should suppress the virus completely and those who think that we should run things quite hot, to use the parlance. And in fact, there have been reports that there's been this division in cabinet. Whether that's true or not, this clearly is this debate. What's your view, and how can decisions be made based on data projections that are imperfect, incomplete, and rapidly changing? I know Hayek always talked about imperfect knowledge. But I wonder, is your traffic light scheme one way of addressing that, or are there other ideas?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, for many years I was an economic forecaster, so I'm very used to data being imperfect and incomplete and, lagging behind. So, in fact, there are many parallels between epidemiological models and macroeconomic models for forecasting the economy in that sense. You know, things are very uncertain. And so I've just forgotten what the question was again.
There's a debate again, between those who think we should suppress the virus and those who think we should run it.
There is a lot of data uncertainty, and it's very similar to doing economic forecasting. But I think the idea that we can eradicate it completely, you know, is a mistake. It will still be there. I think the lockdown was absolutely necessary to avoid the health service being overwhelmed, like we saw in Northern Italy. Yeah. And that did cause, you know, unnecessary deaths. But we've done that now. The NHS capacity has been built up very substantially. And even if there is a second wave, the health service won't be overwhelmed. So I think people are worrying too much about this, the consequences of a slight rise in infections once lockdowns are relaxed. And so that is the idea of the traffic light phase, to try initially to say, well, we've managed to get it under control and the spread's now very low. Let's start a few activities. And it might be that the spread will rise a little bit as a result, but if people continue to behave sensibly, it might not do. And then you just do it gradually, and you'd have very careful monitoring of the rates, especially of new admissions to hospitals. So you track these things very carefully, not just at a national, but at a regional level. And that would be one way of controlling it. So I can see why, you know, if you're the health minister, who, no matter who it is, it's not criticizing Matt Hancock in any way, you're bound to be paranoid about the death rates and the admission rates, because that's what you're judged by. And you're bound to want to minimise these. So ministers as well react to the incentives of their jobs.
That's true. Now my colleague at the IA, Philip Booth, has suggested, particularly in places outside London where there are less of hot spots, so there have been less incidents, that we should perhaps experiment and try out, for example, opening garden centres in areas where there's been low infection, for example, and just seeing what happens. Would you kind of go along with that?
The incidence in the southwest region has been very low, and I think a key reason is that apart from Bristol, there are no real major urban areas. I mean, there are big towns, you know, like Swindon or Plymouth, but they're big towns. They're not big cities. And it's not Manchester, it's not Birmingham, it's not London. So I think it's harder for it to spread then, and the infection rate is very low. So you could indeed try that. I mean, you could actually have, you know, different traffic lights for different regions. It gets a bit complicated, and you might want to have some form of devolution, which again, the government may want to do. But an area like the Southwest would be a very good area to accelerate the release from lockdown, because I say the number of cases has been very low.
I see there have been some suggestions that there should be an easing of lockdown by age as well, under 30s. What do you think of those suggestions?
Well, I was very surprised at the idea that the 20 to 29-year-olds would somehow kickstart the economy. I mean, it's no criticism of them because we've all been young once, but we just look at, as economists, we look at their relative pay. We say, on average, they're paid a lot less than people in their 40s and early 50s. And that's an indicator of their productivity and lack of experience. So when they're 40 and 50, they'll earn more. So the idea that these could kickstart the economy struck me as really rather odd. And if you could think of an age group, a demographic, which was the least likely to continue to observe social distancing and behavioural change, that's the one. So I think it wasn't really a sensible idea at all. Unfortunately, it seems to have faded away. I'm not saying that the main proponents of this had this in mind, but I can't help thinking of these age-based schemes as Remainers' revenge. You know, can we take it out on the people who voted for Brexit and Boris Johnson in some way or another?
I really thought that we kind of moved on from Brexit, so it's interesting that there might still be a remnant of that, if you like. Clearly, people are talking about testing and different types of testing for those who have it, those who have had it. But also, clearly, people are worried or concerned about the lack of a vaccine at the moment. Now, Sir Patrick Vallance yesterday wrote that all new vaccines that come into development are long shots. Only some end up being successful, and the whole process requires experimentation. Coronavirus will be no different, and we should be clear that it is not a certainty. Now, if he's right, how do you see the crisis unfolding over the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, I think just on the vaccine for the moment, he is right, except that there's a paper, a very interesting paper from MIT a couple of years ago, which looked at nearly 500,000 drugs that have undergone the formal testing phases. There are three phases to testing before you get approval in America to actually allow it to be used for the general public. And vaccines had quite a high success rate of all the types of drugs. Although, because what we don't know are ones that are tried in the laboratory and then never put to public testing. But I think he's right. I think it would be foolish to base policy on the idea that a vaccine will become available. Having said that, treatments are now getting well advanced. There are many, many. There's a huge amount of work being carried out, and modern artificial intelligence is making a big difference to this. There are many serious candidates of existing drugs around the world which are getting good reports in terms of treating the virus. So that's something that I think we can be much more optimistic about, something which will treat at least partially this. But that's no reason. We have to say it's not the Black Death. It's not even got a fatality rate of 3 or 5%. The true fatality rate for most people does now seem to be more comparable to a flu epidemic than to, you know, a very dangerous disease. And there are huge costs which are being imposed through the economy being in lockdown, you know, people's mental health and so forth. And we you know, as economists, we're very used to the idea of trade-offs. That's the whole point about economics. You know, we think about, you know, costs and benefits, and there are trade-offs in almost every single action of our lives. And it's a very difficult decision for governments, but they have to form a view on this, and I think start to, you know, bring the country out of lockdown as other countries around the world are doing.
Now, your forthcoming paper for the IEA examines the mathematical epidemiological models that are being used to analyse the spread of the virus, and also make predictions on a number of new cases. Can you explain their scientific value, you know, how they're being used today, and why you believe that they're not being given the same status as, say, scientific research?
Well, if you think of, say, physics, right? If I were to hold a glass up now and say, well, I'm going to let go of it, it'll fall to the floor, and I gave you the exact measurement, I tell you the, you know, all the details you need, then every physicist around the world will give the same answer, because that depends upon a law that's fixed, and it's a law of nature. It's the key parameter in those equations is fixed. It's the same here as it is in Australia, and it's the same here as it was in Britain 1,000 years ago. Now, that's not true as both of economic models and of the epidemiological models, which we mentioned before, are fraught with uncertainty. And certainly, there's a track record in epidemiology and forecasting, which makes economic forecasts look pinpoint accurate. You know, there've been a number of conspicuous examples in the past where people have forecast, you know, absolutely dire consequences for epidemics, and it just hasn't happened. Now, that's not a fundamental criticism of the model. They do have genuine scientific value in the way that economic models have. But I think people can be intimidated by the level of mathematical sophistication, and they just don't have that status at all. The data is imperfect. And the key thing which we started off with, they have to make assumptions, you know, assumptions about behavior. And even minor changes in these assumptions can, in some circumstances, make very big differences to the outcomes. And they have to make assumptions with imperfect information. So their forecast can be, you know, completely wrong in the same way that economic forecasts can often be wrong. And that really needs to be understood by decision makers in government. This is not physics. It's more like economic forecasting.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us today and for answering those questions. That's been fascinating. We very much look forward to your IA briefing paper that will be coming out very soon. For all the viewers, thank you for watching. For more information on everything from the history of or economics of pandemics to classical liberalism and much more, please check out our YouTube channel and subscribe to our IEA Daily Bulletin to stay updated on all our activity. Thank you for joining us.